G-Force, a kaiju podcast.
G-Force?
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.
Kiss you, guys.
What terrible language!
Now, your hosts.
One is me, and the other is Godzilla.
Nick and Andrew.
Hello, and welcome to episode 50 of G-Force, a kaiju podcast, a show in which a rotating cast of kaiju enthusiasts gets together every other week to discuss all things kaiju. My name is Nick, and with me is my co-host.
This is Andrew.
And with us tonight we have...
Hey, this is Evan.
And this is Parker.
And for our big 50th episode, woohoo, the random number generator has decided that we should talk about 1969's Gamera vs. Guron, directed by Noriaki Yuasa and written by Nissan Takahashi.
You said woohoo.
Yes.
But I think that what you meant to say was... Fighter and GTS, and the RNG, of course. All the crazy insights that we've got, and our panel, which rotates a lot. Who knows what movie we'll do next, but never the ones we want. We've done 50 episodes, we've done 50 episodes, we've done 50 episodes.
I'm so glad I'm here tonight.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
Evan, I was really hoping you were just going to keep clapping until it was just...
No, my hands kind of hurt.
I don't think I can follow that, so...
I don't think anyone can follow that.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Next All week right, will yeah. be Godzilla the Series.
That was a really shway podcast, guys. Good job.
Oh, God.
It is hard for me to believe that we are already at number 50. It is simultaneously hard to believe that we've only done 50.
Yeah.
But it has been a crazy 2 years and change.
Yeah, it just about feels like we did 50 Zone Fighters. I think there were probably only 12 of those.
I'm really proud of what we've accomplished so far. And there is definitely no one I would rather be recording with.
Me too. I feel the same way. Also, if you count the bonus episodes, technically, we have done more than 50. But 50 full episodes.
50 numbered episodes. 50 numbered.
50 canonical episodes.
I'm so glad you go. I'm here tonight. I'm so glad.
So I guess we should just move into the movie then. Andrew, would you like to give us our synopsis?
Sure thing. I'm afraid this one will not be in song.
Damn.
When strange radio waves from space are detected, scientists are all abuzz. But Akio, his little sister Tomoko, and their friend Tom have a jump on them, spotting a descending spaceship with their patio telescope. The next day, they go to check it out, and when the boys board the deserted craft, it takes off. They nearly fall prey to a meteor shower, but are saved by Gamera. The flying turtle tries to stop the saucer, but to no avail, and instead follows along, falling behind as the boys are carried to Terra, a planet on the far side of the sun. There, they witness an attack by a space gauss, which is repelled by Guron, the knife-like defender of Terra, who chops the attacker to pieces. The two boys move into the alien buildings, and there encounter two natives, Florbella and Barbella, who look like Japanese women. They explain that they are the last survivors of a dying civilization beset by monsters. The two boys offer to take them back to Earth, but the space women instead probe their minds, learning about Gamera. And subsequently, they plan to physically eat their brains, absorbing all their knowledge and gaining a new food source at the same time, after which they'll repair the crashed saucer and fly to Earth to begin feasting there. Back on Earth, Tomoko does her best to convince Tom's mother and police officer Kondo about the boy's abduction, despite her own mother's skepticism. On Terra, the space women drug the boys and shave Akio's head in preparation for brain harvest. However, they're interrupted by the arrival of Gamera, on whom they deploy Guron. Gamera takes the worst of the battle and collapses into a lake, stricken. After a failed escape attempt, the imprisoned boys accidentally release Guiron, who destroys the flying saucer, and Florbella executes the injured, now useless, Barbella. As Guiron attacks the alien buildings, the boys cries for help, and a helpful dislodged rock help to revive Gamera, and he engages Guiron in battle once more. When the boys accidentally manage to deploy a missile system, they end up unknowingly killing Florbella and give Gamera the idea to use another missile to finish off Guiron. Gamera then uses his flame breath to weld together the crippled spaceship fuselage and carries the boys back to Earth in it. And with their return, Tomoko and her tales of flying saucer abduction are finally vindicated.
So what do you guys think of this movie?
Look, ultimately, a giant turtle flies through space to chase children that are on a UFO, to go to a planet where a gigantic walking kitchen knife fillets a sparkly silver space bat while laughing. What isn't there to like about this movie?
You didn't even get to space women want to eat children's brains. Like, this movie is a gift that keeps on giving. It is a thing of rare and unique beauty. I would say unequivocally my favorite of the Showa era Gamera movies, and I think it may be the one that most purely represents the spirit of Noriaki Yuasa as a filmmaker.
I am not a big watcher of Showa Gamera movies. The opportunity just seldom comes up. My wife doesn't care much for them, and I don't often have the opportunity to watch movies by myself. Zegra, I watch recreationally. Outside of that, I haven't watched any other Showa Gamera film in over a decade, save for Super Monster and Jiger for this podcast. But of those, I do remember Guiron being my second favorite next to Zegra. I love its zany monster concept and just the craziness of the plot. Now, almost undoubtedly, it will come in third in my rankings nowadays, thanks to Super Monster. But even so, I went into this with high hopes.
Well, firstly, I want to apologize in case you hear any loud people in my apartment building. And second of all, I want to apologize in case I'm echoey. I had to record a different room today, so I tried my best to eliminate the echo, but it probably didn't work. But yeah, I really, really, really like this movie. I watched it once last year or the year before, when I was doing a marathon of the Arrow Gamera box set. So this is not counting the times I watched it and skipped to the monster fights as a kid. This is my second time watching it, and I just absolutely adored it from beginning to end.
I just want to commend Andrew on how expertly he left us all in suspense about what he actually thought of the movie this time.
I probably should stop writing like my intros as if find out what I think at the end, when everyone just flat out says what they think at the beginning, except me. But I've gotten into the habit, so I can't stop now.
So let's move on to story and characters.
There are no living things in space.
But the boys really did get on a saucer. And when they did, it took off.
No, dear.
Don't you think that is the truth?
Of course. I know it. You never lie. You're a little lady, a good girl. Yes, don't cry. I'll find Akio on top.
Gamera vs. Guiron stars Nobuhiro Kajima as Akio, Miyuki Akiyama as his sister Tomoko, Christopher Murphy as his friend Tom, Yuko Hamada as his mother Kuniko, Eiji Funakoshi as Dr. Shiga, Kon Omura as Officer Kondo, or Kon-chan, Hiroko Kai as Florbella, Reiko Kasahara as Barbella, and Edith Hansen as Elsa, Tom's mother.
Evan, I have to correct you there. Having watched the Shout Factory DVDs, that is actually Christopher Murphy as Tom.
Oh my God.
Yes, there are multiple versions of the English language credits for this movie, just as there are multiple versions of the English language dub for this movie. And they get different things, like, glaringly wrong. But boy, they both get things glaringly wrong.
That's worse than, like, Koichi Kawakita on the Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah Blu-ray. Because, like, this is an American name. How do you mess that up?
Well, I feel like there's got to be optical character recognition. The computer saw a C with a very small gap between the halves and is like, that is an O. And they just fed it right in to the subtitle thing without, you know, actually ever
checking,
proofreading it. Yeah. Real professional outfit there, guys.
I'm going to change my name to O. Christopher.
I mean, it sounds like some really kind of festive Irish name. It's like, oh, yes, of the O. Christophers from down in the Glen.
O. Christopher Glenchico.
There you go.
Well, I kind of wanted to start our plot human characters thing with a question. Technically, the space women are not actually cannibals.
That's right.
Okay, so we're on the same page.
That's a sci-fi
page.
Okay, thing. They just good. Use cannibal for eats human. In that case, I guess lions are cannibals.
I mean, granted, I'll give the kids credit because they're kids. Like, I'll give them credit for that. But, like, I was watching, I was like, they're not cannibals, though. Like, they're not.
Well, and they're human presenting. We know that they're not physically normally human because we see them with the exact same eyes as the aliens in the previous movie. Which is fine. It's a great effect. Reuse it. But like, as far as they know, those, you know, are biologically the same as them. But then the kids get really nitpicky about a lot of that kind of stuff. So you'd think they'd actually call it out. I just wanted to address another sort of pedantic issue about the movie, along those lines, which is the use of the word star to refer to planets, which happens in the Japanese dialogue and in both dubs. The thing is about that, and people, you know, sort of cite that as a mistake. And yeah, in the context of the dubs, it is a mistake. But what the issue is that, okay, so historically in English, all those bright things in the sky we used to call stars. At a certain point, when it was determined that some of them were different than others, we said, okay, the ones that are kind of like Earth are planets, and they're not stars anymore. Now, likewise, historically in Japanese, the word hoshi referred to all those things that are bright lights up there in the sky. And then, you know, figured out, oh, some of them are these things that are planets like this, and they have a word for that, wakuse. But they didn't stop including those in the broader category of hoshi. So in Japanese, it's perfectly correct to refer to another planet as a star because it would be a thing that reflects light in space. But you translate that directly into English and it's clearly wrong. They are not on a star, they're on a planet.
You know, that makes a lot of the discussion about Peaceland last season make a lot more sense when they seem to be using the Star of Peaceland and the Planet of Peaceland interchangeably. While we are on the topic of astronomical oddities, Shout Factory subtitles, which, yeah, I got complaints there. They have the scientists say that the surface of Jupiter is covered with frozen ammonia. I'm going to choose to believe that's a mistranslation and not a mind-bogglingly inaccurate statement in the original Japanese script, because if so, that would actually beat out, like, 60s Doctor Who using the solar system as a term for, like, Earth's nine planets or the Milky Way galaxy, either one. They're both called the solar system. That would be a new level of egregious. And unless we're just supposed to take that this is a super scientifically advanced, you know, like a Monster Zero kind of thing, where it's like, actually, Earth technology is so much better. We've landed on the surface of Jupiter in this universe. But also, yeah, we start out with another one of those space narration openings. The Gamera series really loves those things. And the sort of the science lesson included at the beginning made me feel like I was watching Godzilla versus Hedorah again.
Speaking of the opening, I was kind of surprised it did not open with the Gamera song, the Gamera like theme song. I don't know usually I watch these in the context of like a marathon, and this was not the first time I've watched it out of that context, but the first time in quite a while. And I was surprised by that because I thought that most of those movies post Gauss started with that song. And this opening was much more dramatic and much more a typical kaiju film opening.
When that one kicked in, I was actually like, oh, is this its first appearance? Because it's going through its litany of planets, you know, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Earth. And I'm like, oh, that fits this film. But no, apparently it started in Viris, the last film, it just still fit because they have a lot of aliens in Gamera movies. But I was getting all excited. I was like, oh, is this the first time? Is this the first? Oh, it's not. Never mind. Okay. Whatever.
Just going to the opening, specifically the opening credits. Because, you know, we get this little bit of space dialogue at the beginning. But then that opening credit sequence, that like over the dramatic, tumultuous, you know, bubbling lava and explosions footage, it's just a very, very sort of dramatic. Having said there's a you know, planet out there in, or a star out there in danger, then showing this like huge cataclysmic environmental event going on over the opening credits. It's pretty like compelling and memorable.
It's funny you mentioned that bubbling lava, because a couple of nights prior to my rewatch of this, I had just rewatched 1984's Godzilla with the opening with everything just lava bursting everywhere. And I was like, I don't remember this, but it was just an interesting sort of comparison that I had noticed. Not that there's an actual comparison there.
It was a very striking opening, both of them. And I had that after I started watching the Resurrection fan edit, because he actually goes and recreates, you know, he uses the title Godzilla Resurrection, but he recreates the letters being etched on the fire, everything. I don't know how he did it. It was really good. But I was like, oh, wow, I'd forgotten. And like with the music, this is really dramatic. It reminds me a lot of the opening credits of the 1950s James Mason Journey to the Center of the Earth. Just sort of that like almost pipe organ, like super portentous music under these scenes of fire and geological upheaval. It's like, oh, you were in for a prestige film now, son. But in terms of space stuff, the one other thing that just jumped out at me is the old planet on the far side of the sun trope. Like, do you think every sci-fi writer that puts that into a movie or TV show is like, oh man, I just came up with this best idea that no one else has ever thought of. This is going to blow people's minds? Or like, I just really wonder, because like that tired old cliche, it has been used so many times in one particularly terrible sci-fi B movie that I saw especially. But it's also funny that their journey in the saucer in no way shows them or implies them circumnavigating around the sun. Like, they don't seem to be going anywhere near it. Maybe that's when they were unconscious. I don't know.
So the whole 10th planet thing in popular culture really comes back to the point where Pluto was discovered, which was, I don't know the year off the top of my head, but it was like 19th century. And all of a sudden, this thing where we had a number of planets that we had identified changed. It's like, oh, no, there's actually one more. Now, of course, now it's been declassified and it's a dwarf planet or whatever, which means that Planet X no longer functions as Planet 10, because it would be Planet 9 now that Pluto doesn't count. But regardless, the idea that, oh my God, there could be another planet, then put people very much in the mindset of, oh my God, could there be another planet? So it became a very, very big trope very quickly.
You know, I will try and restrain myself from making the case for Pluto's demotion being utter nonsense. It's not even, no one even had the, it's not like some authorities convened. It was like, hey, look, we have officially, like, it's just a group of astronomers, not even all astronomers, not even a universal consensus. It's just like, it's like saying this movie is the best movie in the world because the Academy Awards said it was. Well, so what? Who cares what they say? It's that's basically what Pluto being a dwarf planet is. As far as I'm concerned, it's still a planet. We're up to like 14 now. Deal with it. Don't teach kids less because you can't handle there's more than 9 planets now. Teach them all 14. Don't embrace ignorance. Teach the planets and the dwarf planets. They're still planets. And this is me not getting into it.
I was going to ask you to get into it, and then you went on all that. That was wonderful. Again, I am so glad I'm here tonight. This is great. I do want to comment on, okay, so I know these are films that are targeted towards children. And I watched that with that context in mind, but I thought it was kind of oddly presented that, you know, you have all these scientists saying there's a signal coming from space, and then all of a sudden some random kids just see a UFO land over a hill. No one else sees this. No one else, like, you know, there's no jets. There's no nothing. I just thought it was kind of ever so slightly little too convenient where I was like, okay, so no one else sees this giant spaceship come in. A very cool prop and effect, by the way. But no one else sees this and just flies in, and these kids happen to notice that.
Well, a weird thing to me is, and I try not to think about this, because I really like this movie and I don't want it to suddenly not make sense anymore, but I have to address the fact that it literally does not make sense. And that is, nobody believes in aliens in this movie, even though the fact that the previous movie was Gamma versus Virus, which included aliens that came to Earth in a spaceship. And it's canon. They mention it. The kid mentions it to Flobella, and they show the stock footage of it. They show the stock footage of the spaceship. It doesn't make sense that nobody thinks aliens exist in this movie. And that kind of frustrates me. But again, I try not to think about it because I like this movie too much.
That's true. I would say you just shouldn't try and apply continuity until they bring in the stock footage to literally say, no, this actually happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the kid remembers it.
I was thinking maybe it's just loose continuity. And I was like, nope, it's just straight up there.
I just want to be clear that that was not a criticism of the film. I adore this movie. Like, I know my opening remarks were not super clear on where I stand on this, but I love this movie. So that was not trying to criticize it.
I'm going to be upfront that most of what I'm about to say is distilled pretty directly from David Callett's audio commentary on the Arrow Blu-ray edition of this movie. But this movie is a fairy tale, so it functions completely according to fairy tale logic. You know, it's kind of a Hansel and Gretel, kind of a Little Red Riding Hood. Noriaki Yuasa was telling stories to keep children alert to danger and wanted to speak to them very much at their own level, and himself was kind of a great big kid. And he was a kid who believed that adults were useless hypocrites.
A fair assessment.
This is largely attributable to him as a child hearing anti-war sentiments expressed by people who had just come back from fighting a war. Now, you know, we talking as adults can probably mostly see how coming back from fighting a war could really make a person be anti-war. But he sort of clung to very childlike ideals throughout his life in ways that by all accounts made him out just a very sweet, like, wonderful man, and kept him, made him very good at working with children and making them, you know, comfortable on set. But his movies, this movie in particular, as I said in my intro, I think this in some ways is like the purest testament to Noriaki Yuasa's attitudes as a storyteller. The adults just, they'll believe whatever's convenient for them in the moment. And that's how they work. And only kids are upfront and honest and clear about what's going on. And only kids really think things through and like understand the consequences of their actions, which is why the kids are right about everything in this movie. Every nitpick that the kids have about the science, something happens to explain it away so that it makes sense to them. So this movie is beautifully told from a very, very unique child's perspective with a child's morality and a child's sense of cause and effect.
That's very interesting because I'm reminded of, you know, a lot of the sort of the secular humanist principles, the philosophy and ethos that underlies Gene Roddenberry's work on Star Trek. Seems like it came from sort of an experience, you know, around the same age that he went into, like, I think a Catholic church, and sort of the talk of the body and the blood with the Eucharist, you know, sort of really scarred him and freaked him out. And that sort of drove him to find what was the opposite, you know, and underpinned a lot of his future work, which it is interesting that so many of these sort of creative geniuses, especially in the sci-fi field, can just be based in one strong childhood encounter that sort of shapes their creative philosophy for the rest of their lives.
It was an enlightening experience listening to that audio commentary.
I can imagine.
Transcendental almost.
I just want to say, I do really love Noriaki Yuasa, and I enjoy I like how just genuinely, how much he had a genuine want to make movies that could make kids happy, I guess. I just think it's very nice.
Back to the boarding of the flying saucer. First of all, I just have to question something that seemed funny. My wife made the observation first, but it's funny to me that when they are going up into the mountain to find the saucer, they have winter coats. The branches are bare. Their breath is visible, but Akio is still in short shorts. Like, that's just like a Japanese kid thing, I guess. Like, why are you wearing short shorts on what is clearly a freezing winter day?
I just want to chime in that I worked with a man who, when we had that whole what's called polar vortex thing, he still wore shorts. Some people are strange, man. They like their shorts when it's really cold.
I really have to ask, though, what would the aliens have done? And this is a fair point. If it's fairy tale logic, okay, this undercuts a lot of what I'm going to say. But I'm going to look at the scenario as presented and try and reason it through, which is, you know, a thing I do, take movies literally. This is something that may have been noticed once or twice by my compatriots. What would the Terras have done if the boys had not pressed a bunch of buttons to initiate the saucer takeoff? And it's interesting they didn't really spell out the whole trap plot later in the film and be like, ah, yes, we did this in order to do this. It was nicely understated and implied for a kid's film. But at the same time, like, is just this just their, like, super cautious way of scouting? Like, send out a ship, somehow knowing there was a habitable planet on the other side of the sun, even though the rest of their species didn't head for it. And they also have a small craft, even though the rest of their species was all on one big one that got destroyed somewhere, looking for somewhere else. And then have this unmanned ship land, hope that something would climb inside and activate the liftoff controls to bring back specimens for them to investigate, learn from, then plan to return to their planet and blend in, except for some reason the guidance didn't work and the ship crashed on return, necessitating repairs. For no apparent reason, it feels like it would have been a lot simpler to just take the manned craft there to investigate in person, and not significantly more risky than just staying on the post-apocalyptic planet on which they currently live.
I have nothing to say. I wasn't expecting an Andrew rant tonight because I thought that there was really not much here to rant about, but I'm glad that I was proven wrong.
I mean, you're right. Like, there's no sound explanation. You're right. Like, congratulations. I got nothing. I don't think anyone can give you any kind of explanation for all of that. You win. The movie is nonsense.
You found a plot hole in a Gamera film. Congratulations, I guess. So, just some random notes about the characters in this movie. Tom distracts Officer Kondo by shooting a suction cup dart, which hits...
That's not how suction cups work!
Wait, it hits the towel, carries it across the room, and somehow pins it to the wall despite the suction cup being on the far side of the towel from the wall. Like, I get that they are establishing Chekhov's dart gun, literally, so that it can be used later, but, like, what was that? That's not how physics work, unless this thing has, like, the momentum and weight of, like, the iron arrow that kills Smaug in Peter Jackson's Hobbit films, but also, like, yeah, how does it suction to the wall from the other side of the towel?
So we've talked a lot about the space stuff in this movie, so I think it's time to talk about the space women themselves, Flo Bella and Barbella, who are wonderful. They look fantastic. They have great costumes. Wearing all that silver and stuff, you know, classic. They got those cool helmets, classic. And their eyebrows are cool. They're like sort of angled upwards. It's really, really great. They're fantastic. When I watched this, I mean, I was expecting it, but when I watched this during my Arrow marathon, even though I knew it was coming, I was still kind of sad when it turned out that they were bad because, like, they just seemed so nice at first. Like, Flo Bella, like, when she's listening to Akio, like, list off all the planets and she's, like, nodding along and stuff, I'm like, they just seem, like, so nice and, like, welcoming that it's, like, disappointing that they're bad, but they're also, like, still really great when they're bad. So, yeah, that's my piece on the space women.
They also have absolutely no compunction about literally holding children at gunpoint, which was...
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, on that, though, to be fair, most human farms and stuff have like baby goats, lambs. They're not human.
Yeah.
So to them, the human kids they have aren't. They're cat. Like, to quote a very great character from an amazing Godzilla movie, Final Wars, they're cattle. So
yeah, it's funny. That always bothers me as a sci-fi trope. Even like in Planet of the Apes or whatever, you know, and even in Tim Burton's remake where he's like grabbing the guy's mouth, he's like, oh, what, is there a soul in there? It's like, I get that we treat animals differently than us. You know what animals can't do? Talk to us in rational conversation and reason in every possible way that we can. Like,
well, they can. We just can't understand them.
That's true. We don't have a universal translator where we can talk to cows.
It just always feels weird to me that they have aliens treating people the way that we treat animals, whereas the behavioral, cognitive, and language barriers that exist between us and animals are not there to excuse it. Like, it doesn't make any sense on what you base this inferior life form thing at that point. Like, okay, you want to say in Star Trek that humans are inferior because they're like the only species in the galaxy without 8 million extra magical powers of like super healing and super senses. Sure, fair. We're biologically inferior. But like, I've never gotten that in sci-fi. Like, if they couldn't understand us, if they couldn't understand that we are reasoning beings, but I'm pretty sure that any time that happens with animals, people generally hold off from eating them. Like, no one was holding out a knife and fork, just waiting for Coco the gorilla to pass away so that they could chow down. Maybe that's overstating it, and there are some people that feel that, you know, people treat animals that way. But it seems to be this universal thing in sci-fi that's always bothered me. So I apologize for the tangent. I just wish they would better justify when it's like, we're talking like you, we're reasoning like you, we can work technology, we can do mathematics. At what point do you think we're not like you in existential terms?
Here's the thing about that, though. Human beings who can speak the same language do it to each other.
True?
Yeah. Yeah.
As much as anything else, as much as it's commenting on our relations with other species, sci-fi is continually commenting on our relations with each other in a metaphorical context. And people are unconscionably cruel to other people with terrifying frequency throughout history.
Very true.
And, you know, every bit into the modern world.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really wish I could disagree with that, but I can't.
Oh, man. Thanks, Gamera versus Giron. You have bummed me right out.
Thanks for really bringing the mood down, you dismembering, brain-eating movie that's supposed to be a barrel of fun.
Listen, okay? A giant walking knife fillets a space bat. The movie is so fun. You're not supposed to worry about any of those moral implications. You're just supposed to watch a space bat get completely decapitated and butchered by a walking kitchen knife before fighting a giant flying turtle in space. Like, it's wonderful. All I had to say was that the space women are pretty rad. They're pretty cool. I like their costumes. Their costumes are cool. But that's all I really had to contribute to that.
Look. The moral of the story here is don't eat children.
That's a good lesson, yes. If the space ladies had just been nice to the children would have taken them back to Earth, and the space ladies would have integrated into our society, and, you know, I guess their culture might have been kind of erased, but they wouldn't have died on a freezing rock menaced by Giron.
Well, I figure they probably just become secret serial killers and start, abducting people to eat their brains anyway. So it really would have worked out a lot better for them. They would have had a whole planet full of...
Oh, dude, I would have watched the hell out of that. I would watch the hell out of that. I would pay good money to watch that.
Were they going to land on Earth with kid brain on their breath and think that everything was going to go fine?
They've got mints, you know, they have an advanced civilization. They've developed Altoids.
Kid brain on your breath. That is the most incredible sentence I've ever heard.
Oh, that's a pleasant mental image.
Welcome to episode 50 of G-Force.
But, you know, speaking of the development of their civilization, it is an interesting idea, I thought, that seemed like they were conveying, that I actually thought was kind of a neat one, that a civilization could get so powerful as to control nature and the laws of physics, but then a simple computer malfunction of their system could have catastrophic physical ramifications because of how much their technology now allows them to control. When it goes wrong, it's much more devastating, which is a cool idea.
And let me tell you why I think that is. Why I think this is what happens. Why I think their computer somehow makes the world have monsters. What kind of monsters? Specifically, Gauss. Why is that? The answer comes from Gamera 3. They have completely controlled the environment of Terra. They've slaved it to their computers. The computers have screwed up. The environment has gone haywire wacky. Everything is out of balance. Mana is depleted. And a planet losing its mana generates Gauss. Or attracts them or something. But it is because they screwed up their environment, they sucked away their planet's mana, and that's why they have a post-apocalyptic Gauss world, just like the one that Gamera 3 threatens we could end up with.
Dude, I'm so glad I'm here tonight. I'm so glad. So glad.
The mic has been dropped. That's bravo. Bravo. I think that is perfect. That is absolutely perfect.
Evan has been hyping up this Gamera 3 connection like all week. And honestly, I think it's genuinely like really cool. And I think that's my headcanon now. They didn't have enough mana. All the Gauss came over.
Oh, it's mine entirely. I'm fully on board with that. That's wonderful.
I will say on that topic, I really noticed this time, and I kind of like the idea that this is the first film that sort of implies Gauss as a swarm or an enemy that attacks in numbers. The idea that they are sort of a plague or a crowd, as far as I remember, with my hazy memories of the original versus Gauss film, maybe that already did. But that's what it seemed like to me, which is just sort of a nice, you know, a gift that really kept on giving.
No, to my recollection as well, you would be correct. This is the first one that kind of suggests that Gauss is not just a singular monster, but like a whole, an actual species. The interesting thing, though, is there's really no explanation as to why he's silver. I love Space Gauss. We'll get to Space Gauss in the monsters version, I guess. But no, there's really no explanation as to why he's different than the Gauss that arrives on Earth, to my understanding at least. I'm sure there's headcanons there.
Because it's space.
Well, sorry, guys. You're right.
Have you ever been to space and seen like a space frog? They look completely different from an Earth frog.
Next time I go to Jupiter and look at a frog, I'll think of you. I'll text you. And I'll ask you to send me a picture of a real frog.
Well, not completely different. They're still, you know, because you see Gauss and you
like
still
they're still frog-like.
Yeah, like you see...
Just sparkly and silver.
You see Gauss and you still say, okay, that's Gauss. It's the same.
So, wait, so Twilight was about space vampires. Twilight was about space vampires. That's why they were sparkly and silver. It was about space.
Twilight is actually a sequel to Planet of the Vampires.
I was trying to find a way it connected to Planet of the Vampires. Thank you, Evan.
All part of the alien vampire verse.
If I had never heard of Twilight and you said to me Twilight is about space vampires, I'd say, okay, show me that movie series.
I'd be so much more interested. I'd be on board. I actually now I kind of want to rewatch Twilight in the context that they are space vampires. I'm sold. I'm sorry, Andrew.
Should we talk about characters?
On the topic of the space women, one other thing that I had about them, I am completely unclear on how they survived the saucer's midair destruction by Gwiron. And I'm also unclear on why they survived the midair destruction, like plot-wise, since Florbella never meets up with the boys or does anything else in the plot before being perfunctorily dispatched. Like, what was the purpose of prolonging them so that one can shoot the other and then go into a building and get blown up when you could have just killed them off in the saucer being destroyed, being hoisted on their own Gwiron petard? Like, I don't understand.
Well, it was another chance to show that adults can't be trusted because they can't even trust each other. They're good for nothing and they only think about themselves. Darn it. Also, you get that wonderful moment where you see the explosion happen in the background of a special effects shot, and then you cut in to see Flobella, you know, meet her end.
Man, those kids really kill a person. They don't even know it. They don't even know that they just took a person's life.
They probably, it feels like they would cheer if they knew. They would be happy.
Yeah. Yo, that kid watches Space Gauss get decapitated and like cut up into little pieces, and he looks completely disinterested. He does not care about what he's seeing, and it's hilarious. I love that kid's performance because he constantly looks bored out of his mind, and it's so good. Talking about Akio, by the way, specifically.
Yeah, no, Tom's much more enthusiastic.
And irritating, but it's okay. Like, I don't normally mind kids in Gamera movies. Like, I don't care. Like, I'll never have the complaint about, oh, the kids in kaiju movies are so irritating. But the kids in this one, they're fine up until the point where Gamera's fighting Giron, like, towards the end. And then they're just, like, yelling at him the whole time. Like, telling him what to do and shit. And it drives me crazy, man, because they're just yelling the whole time. And I'm like, yo, guys, shut up. But they're fine the rest of the time.
I just had one quick thing to chime in with the space woman before we move on to the children. I'm going to do my first G-Force headcanon. Like, official headcanon. The reason the space woman wanted to specifically eat the brains of the children is because their brains are slowly like decaying because they're fucking stupid. When they're chasing those kids into the like the teleporter, and the kids walk like two steps through the teleporter and around the side, and their response instead of going around the side is to walk through the teleporter. That's when it became clear to me that the space women are not the sharpest tools in the shed, shall we say. So that is my headcanon. The reason they specifically want the brains, they want to absorb the brain power of the children.
I like it. Obviously, they were going to get the witch into her own oven, Parker.
There you go. This really is just Hansel and Gretel in space.
I have nothing. I have no rebuttal to that. So again, as I said earlier, very, very valid point.
I just have to say, when they prepare the snack for the kids, I am so confused. So, like, sometimes in anime, it really is powdered donuts and not just rice balls where they've changed the dubbing. Like, it shatters my whole worldview of how animes are converted.
Listen, that milk looked awful. It was so watery. That milk was so watery. It was so gross looking.
Yeah.
I know Nick wants to rave about the donuts, and I'll let Nick rave about the donuts, but
they look so good.
Yeah, but that milk was so watery. It was like 50-50. It was, oh.
Yeah, but the donuts, they look great. They look so good. And here's my thing. Like, I don't really care for like powdered donuts, to be honest with you, that much, but they just look so good in this movie. Every time I watch it, I'm just like, oh, I want those donuts so bad. And it's funny. I love the part where Flo Bell is like talking to like Akio, like in his mind or whatever. And, you know, it's like kind of here and there sort of projecting his thoughts on screen, I guess, mostly so they can have an excuse to show some Gamera stock footage. And she's like, what do you want most right now? And then an image of donuts just pops up on the screen. It's so good.
Thank goodness that they got some. Someone as innocent as a kid to ask that question.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd forgotten that, like, the requisite clip show. I'd forgotten that was a thing because it wasn't really there in the last couple that we watched. And I had just forgotten how intrusive and absurd that those end up being. But yeah, I love that they talk about Gamera as a hero that comes when you need him. And as they are saying that, they are showing Gamera knock down a lighthouse with a child inside. But then, you know, he saves the child. That is not exactly a sterling recommendation for his, like, heroic credentials.
I just like how they specify that he saved a child in Hokkaido once. In response to what Nick said about the kids a minute ago, I like Christopher Murphy's performance. I like Tom. Christopher Murphy. I like Tom, except for one moment, which is when Kondo sticks the dart on his head and he turns because they need to show the camera the dart stuck to his head. And he, like, straight up just breaks the fourth wall, mugs to the audience. That's my only issue with Tom. Akio, on the other hand, is joyless and smug and irritates me. And yet I love him, and I love his presence in the movie, but like, he's the boy you love to hate. I am so sympathetic to poor Tomoko, having him as a big brother.
See, I thought we were headed toward he's joyless and irritating, and I wish they had eaten his brain.
That would be hideous.
He's endearingly joyless. His joylessness is his best quality.
It's what keeps him alive.
I have maybe a partial explanation for that. Because his mom, when Tomoko is like trying to tell her about the saucer stuff and everything, she's like, study or you'll never get into a good school. Like, this girl is like six. What kind of horrible, like, what is she doing to these children? She's putting the pressure of their academic future on the six-year-old girl. Like, no wonder Akio turned out joylessly if this is the way they're being raised.
I think the mom does put a lot of pressure on the kids. I think she is struggling as a single parent, working. And I think we get a hint as to why she is a struggling single working parent, and there is no father in the picture in an era when, you know, normally there would have been. And I think that there is a reason that Akio specifically wants a world with no war and no traffic accidents. And I think that some of Akio's, you know, downcast demeanor could be because he's still dealing with the loss of his father in a traffic accident. I don't think that's intended at all, but...
Man, this movie is... Just...
You know what? Death of the author.
We've been having such fun, and then it's just such a downer again. Like, the highs and lows.
Death of the author. I see it there. I see it there. It is my headcanon.
Episode 50 lifts you up into the depths of the heights of hilarity and then plummets you into despair. It's a roller coaster ride of emotions.
Here's the thing, though. There's actually a real world explanation for the traffic accidents thing. And that's, you know how you watch a kaiju movie. Evan, you might actually know this. I don't know. But you watch like anything from like Japan and like the 60s or 70s, I guess. And you know, there's the whole like stereotype of little kid with the yellow hat on. And that's because of the amount of like latchkey kids back then in Japan whose parents were always at work. Kids would often have to walk home from school by themselves. And there was a very unfortunate amount of kids getting hit by cars. Like, it was an actual like problem because of it. And that's where the yellow hats come from, because it would make the kids more visible to drivers. And so when he's so fixated on a world without wars or traffic accidents, the movie is specifically referencing that. But that said, that is a really good and really sad headcanon.
Yeah, but okay, no, you're good point. Headcanon withdrawn.
Wow. I think that's the first withdrawn headcanon on this show.
Yeah, we don't have a sound effect for that. Wait a minute. Let's play it in reverse.
It's not a headcanon that brought me any joy. Like, it's kind of a headcanon that I'm happy to be rid of. Now it's just about real world
sadness,
dead children. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Nick.
Jesus Christ.
So Tom's mom is really weird.
Yeah.
She seems to take Tomoko, like, seriously. She gets a police officer, drives them to the site, then immediately dismisses Tomoko completely like she never believed her in the first place. Like, why did she go to all of that trouble if she thought everything Tomoko was saying was nonsense?
I mean, the kids are still missing. I don't know. Maybe you can glean some kind of truth. I don't think that she's a very bright woman. I also don't think that that Akio and Tomoko's mom is a very bright woman. As evidence, I would point to the part where we see Tomoko upstairs listening into their conversation. She realizes that she has to get down and communicate directly with Tom's mother. Both women are standing right next to Tom's mother's car. Their eyes are more or less directed towards the car. They're a couple of feet away from it. somehow Tomoko is able to dart past them and get into the back seat of the car completely unnoticed. These women are lost in a fog. These women are not in touch with reality at all. These are truly, truly clueless, hypocritical adults.
Yeah, but the scene of it being revealed that Tomoko is in her car is so funny. It makes me laugh so much.
I did really enjoy that.
I forgot about it. And this time, like, you know, it shows Elsa, I think her name was, driving. And then I'm like, oh, man, Tomoko's going to be in that car. And then sure enough, she pops up in that back seat. And it's so good.
Every moment Tomoko is on camera is good.
She is fantastic. Her and Khan are the best characters in the movie, hands down.
At least there we do have one adult character who is not hypocritical or entirely useless. I don't have that much to say, but I suspect Evan does.
Yes, speaking of Tomoko and Khan, first of all, I want to point out that Khan Omura, as Khan-chan, is very much a piece of stunt casting. He was a popular comic actor who had a big following among children. In fact, he had, child fans showing up on set disrupting things. And the movie even directly references an ad campaign that he did for a product called Oronamin C drink, which is a carbonated beverage. The glasses slipping down on his face are a callback to the advertising campaign for that product. So,
oh, I did wonder about that bit.
Yeah, his presence in that movie is very much, I mean, look at the fact that his name is Khan Omura and they name him Officer Kondo so that they can go out of their way to address him as Khan-chan. So they're basically just calling him by the actor's name for most of the movie.
So would this be the equivalent of, you know, Frankie Sakai as Sen-chan in Mothra in terms of, like, star power, or?
No, I don't think the equivalent, because it wouldn't have the same appeal to, like, the mass audience, I don't think. It was more to draw in specifically a kids' crowd. But then getting to those characters, I think that Tomoko and Khan-chan are the heart of this movie. I find his faith in her very, very moving, and the faith that she then puts in him, you know, that, like, yeah, as you said, there's one adult who does put some trust in these children. And Tomoko, like, her performance feels really sincere. She is by far the best of the three child actors in this movie. And, you know, her prayers for her brother and her promise to him that Khan-chan is going to find him, it legit gets me emotionally involved in the movie. Where the rest of the time I'm just like, yeah, cool, like, slice him up, or yeah, cool, you know, eat their brain, lady. But, like, no, I will even go so far as to confess to tearing up a little bit the last time of my marathon of rewatches of different versions of this movie prepping for this podcast.
I totally agree with you. I can't really put it any better than you did, but yeah, they're definitely the heart of the movie. Every bit of them on screen is, like, really sweet, I think. And I like that they kind of initially set him up as kind of like, or at least this is how I read it. It seemed like they were setting him up to kind of be like a real stern, like, would be like in the kids' way and everything, but then they just totally, you know, the kids, like, leave in that first scene with him, and then he, like, chuckles, and then it's like, oh, okay, he's actually, like, pretty chill. And then, yeah, they have him be the only adult who actually listens to Tomoko, and it's just, it's very touching, and I love it so much.
One thing in regards to that, a completely different, you know, to be completely emotionally tone deaf to all of your warm talk of relationship. It's weird to me that he threatens to shave their heads as a punishment. Then the space women shave it, which feels like foreshadowing, except it isn't for misbehaving. It's just because they want to eat their brains. They would have done it even if they'd been perfectly well behaved. And then they get back and he says, oh, have you shaved your head in contrition? Like, those three things feel like they should be more connected, and they're not. Like, it feels like he should at least make a call back to his, oh, someone else found you so misbehaving that they shaved your head, did they? It's like, nah, you know, so, It's weird that it happened. The head shaving is brought up three times in three different contexts, two of them by the same character, and they are not related to each other, unless that's just the Shout Factory subs being bad.
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, no, I mean, I mean, yeah, I see what your point. I mean, I see your point. I mean, it's just a thing. it's just a thing. It's like, it's a leitmotif.
It's like poetry. It rhymes.
Yes, exactly.
The get out of jail free card of filmmaking.
Like, yeah, it's not about. Yeah, I.
We broke Evan.
I have an abstract sense of a response and literally no words to put it into. This is the most I've ever failed at podcasting.
You may have just used up your awesome quota for the episode already with those headcanons and connections to literary allusions. But also, does Earth just have an alien ship to reverse engineer now? Like, is there a Heisei-style super tech timeline in a few years, like, post-Zegra that they just didn't make enough films for us to get to? Like, is there going to be a Mecha Gamera built from the reverse-engineered Terran flying saucer at this point?
How do we know that we're not seeing Giron-derived technology in Jiger? Huh? How do we know that?
The Bathysphere is the pinnacle of reverse-engineered alien technology.
I mean, it was reverse-engineered by adults, and they're all just useless idiots and hypocrites.
So if they'd just given it to the kids, we would have flying cars by now. Thanks, Japan. Or thanks, adults. Or I'm confused.
That's why the aliens wanted their brains. They knew how to, the kids knew how to make flying cars. See, guys.
Yeah, I mean, look at how handily the kids solved the problem in Jiger. That's part of what makes that movie so great.
Evan is just begging, just for our listeners. Evan is begging us to do a re-recording of the Gamera versus Jiger episode. I think this should be like our 100th episode. It's Gamera versus Jiger revisited. Hosted by Evan.
Every milestone episode should be a Showa Gamera movie.
I'm so on board for that.
So I do have to ask, though. We have two different Gamera movies that start with paintings of space phenomenon and heavily feature space women. Is there anything interesting that can be said about that, or does that sentence Whoa. Sum up the sum totality?
Whoa. Space of is that cool. Connection?
Space women are cool. And space women are cool.
Yep.
Space bats are cool.
Yep, they're very cool.
Turtles flying in space is cool.
Turtles flying in space is cool.
Zyger comes from space.
I was more referring to the connection.
Big monsters with knives for heads are cool. And Giron is in both movies.
And Space Shark.
Well, that's true, but they're all in both movies because Super Monster uses every monster.
You know what I mean. It's the role of cool, Andrew. It's the rule of cool.
You want to go cool? Space.
Yep.
It's nice that we have good space women and evil space women. It would be nice if we could get a versus movie for those. You know, just a Gamera-less spinoff. It would be cheaper. You could do it as a fan film.
That would be the best.
I'm going to restrain myself.
That would be so good.
Battle of the Space Women.
By could, you mean will. Will. You will do it as a fan film.
Coming to Patreon next season is our Gamera space woman epic. That's gonna be the good space woman versus the bad space woman. It's gonna be amazing.
Oh yeah, that Patreon we used to reference that we were going to make eventually.
Post credits scene: Rip in reality opens up, and out come Namikawa and
yeah. Now we're talking
the Kilox.
Ooh yeah, the Namikawa and the Kilox.
Yeah,
there you go. Yeah. I was gonna go with Katsura, but no, Kilox made more sense.
She's not an alien.
She's got alien parts in her. I think you'd want to bring her in at some point in the sequel, but initially it would just be Namikawa and
maybe they're fighting over Kilox. Katsura. They're fighting over Katsura. It's who controls Katsura.
Ooh. Oh, my, my, my.
Thank you for joining us in episode 50 for Gamera vs. Giron, where we talk about space women.
They created a Mecha Gamera, and they need Katsura.
Dude, no, no.
What?
A Mecha Zygra. A Mecha Zygra. I would funnel all of my paychecks straight into Daiei or Toho just to make a Mecha Zygra.
I don't think this is as affordable as the original fan film pitch was.
Wait.
Parker becomes homeless due to his love of cinema.
Just my love of Zygra.
So this is yet another fan fiction that we are offering to write if people pay us money for the podcast they can listen
Andrew,
for free for the Patreon.
I will write this on Friday. I will write this on Friday. I promise you. If we get any sort of backing, I will write this.
Somebody's brain gets eaten.
Of course.
Mine.
Doesn't have to be a child.
Somebody's
brain gets eaten.
Me. I'll do the cameo. They'll take out my brain and eat it. All right.
Actual topics.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to monsters and special effects. The special effects for this film were directed by Kazufumi Fuji, and Gamera was played by Umenosuke Izumi, and I don't know who played Gauss or Giron. I could not find that information.
This is not a child-friendly film in any way, shape, or form. The Gauss butchering is brutal as hell, and the ninja knives from Giron into the face are brutal as hell. So, you know, as much as it is aimed at children, it is not. Like, I wouldn't show this to my son for quite a few years. It is brutal.
That was my impression, too. I plan on actually doing both the subs and the dubs. I was going to watch the dub yesterday with my sons, and then I watched this with the subs, and we got to the butchering of the space gal scene. I'm like, oh, no, I'm not watching this with them. And I think I might have put this on for them when I was in another room, and I remember they turned it off partway through. I really hope it was before this part, because I did not remember that.
Okay, and the big bad wolf eats Little Red Riding Hood's grandmother and eats Little Red Riding Hood, and the woodsman comes along and cuts open the wolf. And when the prince is looking for Cinderella, Cinderella's stepmother cuts the heel off of one of the stepsisters and cuts the toe off of another one. Like,
yes, and I would not show them movies of that either.
I'm just saying there is a tradition that this belongs to. And in Japanese cinema, the lines aren't drawn exactly where they're usually drawn in American cinema. Although supposedly, one time, a little girl walked up to Noriaki Yuasa in a park and told him that Eiji Tsuburaya had asked her to tell him that there shouldn't be so much violence in the Gamera movies.
That sounds a little far-fetched.
I think part of the thing, just like with those fairy tales, is it's the transition into a different medium that makes it horrifying. Very much like when you try and do Cats as a live-action with CGI film. It the new medium turns what was acceptable in a different medium into something that is just horrifying.
Oh, dude, I can't believe you just made a Cats reference without Elfie here. I can't believe that. I can't believe you just did that.
But, yeah, after the decapitation, that was my moment of like, oh my gosh, what kind of kids movie is this?
Well, you know, also, you know, just to continue off of what Evan was saying, Darth Vader does cut off Luke Skywalker's hand, his own son, and Darth Maul gets cut in half, and Jango Fett gets decapitated.
Obi-Wan Kenobi slices off Ponda Baba's arm and kills Dr. Evazan.
And there was blood in that one, because yeah, that was before they decided that lightsabers don't make blood or whatever.
That's straight out of Yojimbo.
Like, you're right. Like, I agree with you. It's a completely valid point. One I had never considered. I just think that the way it's presented, like, so this is an odd comparison, but like, I will show my son Aliens before I show him Alien. Like, I think there's a difference in the context and how it's presented, that even though Aliens is extremely brutal, I mean, you still have a chest burster scene, arguably a more graphic and gory chest burster scene, there's something about the way it's presented that is a little more visceral and horrifying in the original Alien. So with Giron, as much as, yeah, there's totally violence in old fairy tales, Giron butchers Gauss. And it's never really explained why we have a space Gauss, which is like the coolest thing ever. I love space Gauss. Okay, space Gauss is awesome. But butchers him, and then Gauss's head like roars a bit and then dies. And Giron laughs.
Like, it is so brutal. And but I mean, again, but you are correct. Like, there in terms of the fairy tale context, there is a lot of graphic violence in a lot of fairy tales. But it is a very but granted, most Shao Gamera is very violent and very bloody and very uncomfortable to watch at points.
I'm not gonna sit here and say what you should and shouldn't show to your kids, because I don't care and I don't have kids, so I don't know what that's like to have that thought process. But I will just say that I watched this when I was probably like 5 or 6 years old, and I thought nothing of it. I was like, yeah, it's a giant monster fight. But that's just me, you know. I have no idea how other kids would react to that.
He butchers him and then laughs about it.
But it's like, it's so stylized and like live action cartoony that I just don't.
There's something that Parker will see before this season of The Next Generation is up that is very much like that. There are definitely these things that I know that I'm going, oh gosh, I can't show that to my kids. And it's like, I saw it as a kid. And as parents, we probably do overestimate things that will go completely over our kids' heads. But the one other thing that I can say, as the parent who will have to deal with the nightmares, there's a part of that mentality that there may be 99 things that fly right over their head that you think will be a problem that isn't, but you never know what the one that won't will be.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And I can also understand, it's one thing, because for me, I was picking these movies out at the video store, you know? But I guess it's different when you're the parent and you're exposing the kids to this. I can see you not wanting to be the one that shows them a giant space bat getting decapitated with a monster that has a knife for a head and the blood sprays out of the neck onto the knife head. Oh my God, it looks so good. I love it. But I can understand not wanting to show that to them, because it is disgusting and horrifying, but it looks great. I like it. I mean, I don't, you know, I wouldn't want to see it in real life, but you know what I mean.
I want to acknowledge that I come at this from the perspective of someone who watched graphic horror films from a very young age and never really had a problem with it. And I recognize that that is that's a distinct perspective that is not the majority. Two, I want to say that I actually find this, the violence here kind of broadly cartoonish, which is why I guess it doesn't seem all that like child unfriendly.
Yes, I mean, I totally agree.
Not that I don't see the concern, not that I don't see where, and it's very much a child by child issue. Where one kid's limits are is not going to be exactly the same as any other kid on earth, you know?
Okay, so in response to all of this, I am with Andrew because, I mean, I am also a parent. But my situation is a little different, because while I didn't grow up watching the graphic horror movies, obviously now, you know, Evan, I think I like movies that are more graphic than you do, actually. But it's interesting, though, because I think the point here for me is that I watched Jurassic Park as a kid all the time. It's very graphic. It's horrifying. Right now, my perspective is I'm not showing my kid Jurassic Park for years. But I watched it all the time as a kid. And then I saw Jaws. And Jaws, when I was like 5, completely almost created my anxiety. So it's kind of hard to gauge. I agree, this is definitely portrayed in a more comedic or comical, cartoony, comic booky kind of light. There's a lot of bright colors. It's not like he cuts open Gaius and his intestines are blurting everywhere. But in terms of like a kid's kaiju film, it's not something that I think I would show. I mean, it depends. Like Evan has said, all kids are different. And he's completely right. My kid knows who Michael Myers is. He's not even 4. But he hasn't seen a Halloween movie. But it is all subjective. I wasn't trying to suggest that like no kid should ever watch this. I just know that it's one of those situations where I would probably say that my kid can't watch it. But at the same time, he also cheers very loudly when King Kong rips off Mechagodzilla's head in Godzilla vs. Kong. So look, it's like I said, like Andrew had said, you know, you don't want to deal with the nightmares, but you don't know if they're going to actually give him nightmares or not. So that's just all I wanted to say on that.
And I think a lot of it also has to do with young. At a certain point when they are choosing things for themselves, you know, when you're getting into double digits or even late single digits and they are making the choice to take something on, which is when I saw a lot of these things. It's a lot different from if they're 4, 5, 6, where you are presenting things to them and the responsibility is pretty solely yours. They're not as good at gauging what they can and can't handle yet. But yeah, absolutely. Every kid is different and every parenting style is different. I just know that, yeah, this was not something for my kids. Not right now.
Just wanted to mention that if you watch this movie on television in the United States when it was originally broadcast here, the AIPTV version, that sequence was a lot less brutal. It got as far as Gauss's beam deflecting and cutting off its own foot. Gauss flies away, and then it cut to Accio saying, like, I think it's going back to its home now. And then you see Giron going back underground, and you miss the whole butchering of the Gauss sequence, which also means that if you watch the current versions where that dub has just been married to a full print of the movie, at that point in the movie, the dub bounces back to the Japanese dialogue, which is another way to be sure that you're watching the good dub, because the other dub is so bad. You don't with it.
I won't.
Don't even with it. I won't. Maybe if you're drinking a lot.
I don't drink, so I can't even do it.
Yeah, don't even with it.
You asked why Space Gauss was. Apparently, it was a replacement for the Varan-like manga, a flying squirrel monster that they originally planned to have in that role in the film.
Oh, dude.
They had budget constraints. And so they're like, how about we just repaint the Gauss costume?
That's awesome.
It was a cool design, too. There's like a little sketch of it. It's on Wikizilla.
I've heard nothing of this before.
It's a pretty nice design.
That's really cool.
I think it's like kind of bluish, I think. I don't really remember, to be honest. But it looks cool. Part of me is sad I didn't get to see it. But then another part of me is glad I didn't get to see it, because I'd have to watch that cute little bastard get chopped up.
I think Ultimate Space Gauss is really like an actual cool thing. I think it works in a couple.
I totally agree.
Works in a couple different ways. Like, it's cool, like we had mentioned earlier, that it's like, you know, another member of the species. Visually, the purple and the silver is a really cool color combination, like a super cool color combination. It works so well.
His color scheme is absolutely wonderful. Like you said, the silver and purple.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Like the purple blood is super cool. He has those yellow eyes. I don't remember if like regular Gauss has yellow
regular
eyes.
Regular Gauss does have yellow eyes, yeah.
Well, it still looks good. It works very well with this as well. And he's got some red highlights, I think.
He does. There's not much I can think of that I'd rather, like, I haven't seen this Varan type creature, but like I love Space Gauss. I think Space Gauss is really cool.
I'm gonna say something that is very, very unlike me, which is that I'm really glad that it turned out the way that it did in terms of what monster we got here, because I think Space Gauss, just in bringing Gauss back, establishing it as, you know, sort of a recurring foe, and introducing the idea of it having a swarm or even just being multiple creatures at all. Oh, I'm going to hate myself for saying these words out loud. Was really good for the lore.
You sounded in pain when you said that. You sounded and looked like you were in physical pain.
Dude, again, I'm just so glad I'm here tonight, because I just, amazing.
We're pulling out all the stops for episode 50.
What a twist.
It's just Space Gauss is great. You know, I honestly wonder if, and you know, I really honestly don't care about this type of stuff. Like, I'm not going to see Space Gauss and like question why there's another Gauss on a different planet. I'm just going to go, wow, this is rad. But like, part of me has to wonder if Gauss is just from space and the one that was on Earth just happened to just come to Earth because maybe a lack of mana or something. But Gauss is probably from space in the Showa era.
Well, I feel like it works nice, though, that it does make it feel like what Heisei extrapolated into, that it is a plague that comes when your civilization destroys the natural balance of your planet. And like, yeah, it's going to look different based on the ecology of the planet that it spawns from. But, you know, like we talked about in our last movie discussion episode, with the radiation making Godzilla's birth inevitable, that Gauss is sort of an inevitable consequence of a certain level of technological hubris combined with environmental carelessness, that it is a constant across all worlds. It's just the details of how it looks vary from planet to planet.
Hey, we have to find a way to make a Gamera movie. Full budget, real Hollywood Gamera movie. This is our concept. This is our concept.
Yes. I would be so on board.
So an interplanetary sci-fi film, full budget
Gamera. With Zygarde.
Just to make sure that it's not like the full budget of hiring a lighting crew and some gaffers. But like,
we would have to get all this out over the course of a trilogy.
Of course. We're still working on plotting our like 5-minute short film, but now we're doing a full budget professional Gamera sci-fi planet hopping trilogy.
Yeah, but this one writes itself.
It's true.
As someone who is pretty vocally against the idea of swarms and not particularly the biggest fan of Heisei Gauss, I'm going to say something that I can't believe I'm saying. I love the idea that we're introduced to the concept that Gauss is like some sort of a parasitic species, not just a singular monster, that there are more of him. Again, it's not really explained why this one is sparkly and silver. He's in space. That's okay. But it is a pretty cool, it's not once do I ever watch it and go, well, how the hell is Gauss alive? Like, you just watch it, you're like, oh, cool, a space Gauss, another Gauss. Sweet, rad, I'm in. It is pretty cool. And I love how we're spending all this monster discussion on space Gauss and not on the two monsters that are, like, literally from the title of the film. But
yeah, it is kind of hilarious how we've apportioned out our conversation time this episode on what could have been our shortest episode. But it's like, no, that just gives us extra room. G-Force Unleashed. And I have to say, on the effect side of things, Guiron's jump shot attack and then Space Gauss like spinning out of control and then Gauss just sort of flopping about and its wing flailing, like that particular sequence of him jumping and knocking it out of the air, that was tremendous. Like, the effects are really on par here, except for when they're really not. There's no in between. But this was a really, really on its game kind of a thing. Over on the topic of Gamera, so Gamera just cruises around in space in his free time nowadays? Like, how does that work? I know that I'm not supposed to think about it this hard.
If you had jets attached to your body and you can breathe in space, you would do it too.
So that's my question.
Also, wait, hold on.
How can he breathe in space?
He also got...
He's Gamera.
Well, that's right.
That's
but
why.
He also, not only is he just a super cool turtle who can fly, he also was just previously attacked by a giant space squid.
Mm-hmm.
So as someone who can't stand squids or octopi, I would be patrolling to make sure none of those freaks come back to my planet either. So, I mean, it's kind of a valid understanding to just patrol space.
And if all Gauss are from space, then that's another thing he's got to be on the lookout for.
Yep. Yep, there it is.
I'm not asking his reasons. I'm more asking his biological capability, because technically our one movie before the movie that literally establishes he has lungs by having children walk around in them, I can accept that he's amphibious because fish can extract oxygen from the water with their gills. There is no oxygen in the vacuum of space. How is he surviving and roaring in the medium of the vacuum of space?
Okay, he's really big, right? So, like, his internal biology has room for all kinds of extra organs. There's probably all sorts of oxygen sacs where he can store all kinds of oxygen.
Are we saying that he has a Time Lord respiratory bypass system here? Is that what we're going with?
I was going to suggest he may have one of those rebreather things from Phantom Menace that Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon have, that he just whips out of, it's hiding under his shell. He just, you know, puts it right over his mouth. He's able to breathe in space.
I think when the Atlanteans created Gamera to fight the Gauss that come from space when your planet doesn't have enough mana, I think they said, hey, we should probably have a guy who doesn't need oxygen. And there it is.
Well, then why were they spending so much time in his lungs in the next movie?
Hey, guys. Thanks for letting me get away with, he's really big, so there's room for extra organs. Because, like, if James had been here, his head would have exploded.
So, this may just be me, But there's something about legless, flaming Gamera flying alongside the saucer that is just so uncanny to me. Like, despite the effects in the sequence being pretty universally good, so not seeing just half a Gamera like that just makes him seem way too unreal to me. I don't know what it is. I don't know why my brain draws a visual suspension of disbelief barrier there, of all places, in this movie. But something about it was just really freaking me out.
This may be a difference of did or did not watch these movies a bunch on TV as a little kid. Because while I don't have very, very specific memories of what Gamera movies I watched on TV as a little kid, where there are certain Godzilla movies I can zero in on, like, yes, I definitely watched that one when I was little. Images of Gamera in his various weird states of flight are what was burned into my brain as a little kid. That was most of my takeaway of Showa Gamera until I started watching them again much, much later. Was just all these weird memories of what Gamera looked like flying around.
Just really quick, I want to say that I just think that Showa Gamera is adorable. And that's kind of it. He's just cute. I also want to say that I think it's really cool when he's fighting Giron, who's shooting the ninja stars out of his head, and he picks up the like stalagmite looking thing off the ground and starts blocking them. It's awesome. And it's not even just awesome in it's so goofy, I love it, but it genuinely like looks good. Like the way he's moving is very smooth, and I'm like, this just looks great. It's probably my favorite part of the fight. It's genuinely so good.
My favorite part of that in particular is that he's deflecting it with one hand while the other hand he still has the snow on his face to kind of help with
it.
So he's like, this hurts. Fuck off.
He's so talented.
Yeah, the packing the ice on his wounds, that is just so like sad and
it's
empathetic.
So you're
just
it's
like,
empathetic,
oh man,
yeah.
Poor Gamera. And the producers, you know, and then he's deflecting the stars with a stalactite. Like, I feel like the producers have said there's so much blood and everything because they want to make use the gore to make these kaiju seem more animalistic. And yet they have the most like sympathetic and anthropomorphized kaiju of the entire genre. Like, it feels like, no, whether people identify these as animals or people happens before the blood starts. And because they've already decided they are people, it makes the blood so much worse. Like,
dude, that little hop he does as he's like in pain from the stars on his face is so, there's something instantly relatable to it. That little like just hop up and down while he's clutching his face because, you know, he's in pain. No, it's awful.
Yeah, no, Gamera is so like spirited in this movie. You have and has such a sense of purpose in like soaring across the solar system to save these kids. And I really like the way that it kind of builds tension by having to keep cutting back to Gamera on his way to that distant sparkling object, which reminds me of the diamond that becomes Gigan in Godzilla versus Gigan and Godzilla versus Megalon, that sort of like distant glistening blue image. Anyway, once he does get there, his performance there, both his fighting moves and his kind of anthropomorphic expression is all totally on point. That is some good Gamera-ing.
He's right.
I was just gonna switch gears, talk about Giron, whatever.
I think that's a good idea.
I think Giron is rad. I think most show. I actually don't know. I think all the Showa Gamera villains are pretty instantly recognizable, pretty instantly, I don't want to say iconic, but there's something that just instantly works about every design, even Jiger, that just, they're instantly super cool. And they're different than the Godzilla monsters. I don't know how to exactly explain that, but they do feel different than the Godzilla kaiju. But Giron is awesome. Giron is rad. I love everything about Giron.
They feel more cartoony than Godzilla monsters. Like these feel
they're
like
simpler. Yeah. Yes. There's something. Yeah. They're definitely a little more simpler in design.
They're simple and they have immediately recognizable silhouettes.
Yep, very defined features.
To me, Giron is the most instantly iconic monster of the entire Showa Gamera batch. I know that's probably Gauss for most other people, but like Yeah, just the fact that he is a giant living knife. It's so absurd, but I completely adored it. It just makes him so iconic and so memorable. I also noticed that he has suckers on his palms, which they would a design choice they would reuse for Jiger in the next film. Yeah, he just does such a great design. And he has a great intro. That first intro shot as he's coming up out of his cavern where the camera is like starting overhead and coming down to his level, and he has that like stark blue lighting on him from the pit that he's in. So such a great, just iconic reveal shot.
And the water running backwards is super cool. Like before he shows up, that is great. But yeah, as a kid, I saw a Guron figure in like a store in Pittsburgh one time, like a comic shop thing. And to this day, I very much regret not getting it because I absolutely love Guron so much. I still don't have a Guron figure and I need one because he's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I gushed about him a lot already in our episode about Gamera's character, but like he's a big monster with like a knife for a head and it's so good. And
his roar is pretty like, it's pretty standard, but it somehow it works completely. Like yes. It's not nothing special, something you like super unique. It's kind of just a guttural sort of roar, but it works really well with that design.
Yep. And he shoots ninja stars out of his head. And that's so cool.
Yeah, like telekinetic throwing stars that make Gamera weep blood. That is intense, man.
So metal.
I also thought his slowly chopping through Gamera's shell, and at first it seems like, Gamera can block him, and then the blood starts showing up. That makes him feel so menacing. You're just like, oh no. The Gamera is not safe there. Oh no. It's Dude, really good.
The wounds in Showa Gamera movies are so like visceral, and like that one in particular, I'm watching it and it's like, oh my God, that has to hurt like so much. I'm pretty sure like the shell of a turtle is like part of its like bones. Ah, and it's just so like, it's so gross looking and it's just, it's horrible, but like in like a good way, like it's, they did a good job at making it horrible. And then I love Gamera, like just in that same scene, just grabbing Guron's wrist and just pulling his whole hand into his mouth and like biting down on it. It's great.
There are different ways that we respond to different kinds of cinematic violence. And in Toho movies, when the monsters are like seriously injured by each other, a lot of the times it's this, you know, big ambiguous slashing ray comes by and something happens, or you're getting shot at by, you know, tanks, or, you know, there's a missile that flies and hits your body. And it's not things that most people can sort of relate to in their daily lives. Whereas it's kind of the lesson of Dario Argento's Deep Red in presenting violence in ways that feel like things in your household, things in your immediate surroundings, things every day are immediately perilous and like painful in ways you can understand from ways you may have actually, say, cut yourself. And yeah, Guron as an opponent, all of its weapons are things that when it hits Gamera, like you kind of have a sense of what that feels like, you know, accidentally cutting yourself with a Ginsu knife or, you know, cutting yourself on the face with a razor. It stings to watch.
Yeah, no, I fully agree with Evan. I think you watch most of these kaiju films and typically most of them are just sort of like on the surface, like boom, explosion because you got hit by a lightning bolt, or, you know, boom, fire explosion because you get hit by a tank. It's not typically as, I guess, visceral, I guess is the word we're using, but it's not as overtly bloody, gory. Not that these are kind of gory, but it's a different type of violence. And yeah, no, the Showa Gamera films are very, like when those flying stars hit Gamera, you know, it's not like just the point goes in. And it's not like the whole thing goes in and then bounces off. It's like just the tip of that star goes in, and the rest of it is still standing out. So, like, no, you probably haven't been hit by a flying ninja star, but I'm sure at some point you've cut yourself or had some sort of, you know, a razor blade or a knife or a box cutter, and you instantly go, okay, like Evan was saying, you know, in some way, shape, or form what that feels like. And that's why I was saying earlier that little hop that he does is that there's this sort of like, just, you have to like exert energy when you get hurt. Like there's just this ow, 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 ow. And it's really hard to watch actually sometimes, where you go, man, don't beat the guy up that bad.
And seeing him, you know, pack it in ice drives home the like, this physically hurts him. The fact that he was wounded is still there a minute later, you know? He doesn't have Godzilla's immediate recovery.
And then the boys make a stupid joke about him doing the go-go, and you're just like, shut up, kid! Gamera's in pain! Show some sympathy!
He saves your lives and you make fun of him. So ungrateful.
It's like the Princess Bride. You mock my pain! I thought another thing that really upped the intimidation factor, I liked the fake out with Gamera's strafing run, how he flies low over the buildings and turns around. It's initially made to look like he's about to repeat Space Gauss's mistake. It's like the exact same approach, the same shots. He's following the same path, which I feel like works nicely to convey a sense of menace. Like, oh no, we've seen how this ends. He's about to get, Guren's going to jump, and then he's going to chop him up and cut off his head and laugh. But, you know, it's a fake out. I thought it was a really effective one. There are a lot of really nice touches throughout the battle that really helped to up that menace, that in a lot of ways, you know, I feel more worried for Gamera in this battle than in any of the other ones that I've watched outside of the Heisei trilogy. That said, the part where he flies and does the peril gymnastics bar, like, I don't even mind the gymnastics bar. It's fun. It's for kids. But the way that he goes, like he sort of dives down and then back up as he's flying through the, it makes like the tail slide in Megalon look like an aerodynamic simulation done in, you know, a wind tunnel to approve NASA spacecraft. Like, it's really painful. Just like the flight path of the missile that kills Florbella. It was apparently set on like space woman seeking mode, because it in no way flies in any kind of straight trajectory.
But it's a wonderful shot, though. It's such a wonderful shot.
Oh, it is.
So, you know, who cares?
It's just the execution is. That's the one weak point of the effects. The other, to me, is like the green screen or whatever kind of compositing they're doing. The scuffed, scratched, wrinkled green screen that, like, at the end, I thought the last shot they did of it with Tomoko running toward the wrinkles with her white sweater looking lemon yellow really encapsulated the compositing problems they had in this film.
The composites, actually, I think the composites are pretty good in terms of matte lines. They don't have bad lines. But yes, the rear elements always look like garbage. And I think we need to just take into account that, okay, so Toho had Eiji Tsuburaya, and Toho had a lot of money to throw at Eiji Tsuburaya, and he had this big department with a full staff, and they had an in-house compositing department. And as we discussed in the Mothra versus Godzilla episode, they bought Tsuburaya the highest quality, you know, compositing equipment in the world at the time, stuff that like only Disney had. And Daiei had no in-house compositing department at all. Really no in-house special effects department at all. But all these composite shots had to be sent out to another facility for processing, which was a costly process and left them with less direct control over what was happening. And really, in terms of even figuring out how to do this, Yuasa just had to go and observe the process of these shots being done and figure out on his own what elements he needed to shoot for them to be able to put these things together. So viewed through the same lens as what Toho was producing at the same time, yeah, this is unforgivably cheap looking. But viewed through the lens of the astonishing accomplishments of a badly underfunded and understaffed team trying to pull off miraculous imagery, I think it's forgivable.
I still think it looks pretty bad, but how can I say mean things after such an eloquent defense?
What is this movie brought out in me?
Gamera versus Giron brings out the best in all of us.
It didn't do any good. Let Giron out.
I did just want to talk a little bit, just because I enjoy getting into the nitty gritty of how monsters' names come about and get translated and transliterated. And a question in our prep for this episode, a question about how to pronounce the enemy monster's name came up. And it's one where I just don't think that there is one answer for how an English speak. Obviously, if you're speaking Japanese, then you're going to naturally want to say it exactly the way that it is said in Japanese because you're speaking Japanese. But in terms of English language conversations, where it's not like, as with, say, Godzilla, where there is a definitive anglicized version. Here's the way to consider this monster's name. To start with, it's derived from the word guillotine. So that first sound is gi. But in rendering that in katakana characters, rather than using the gi character, as in King Ghidorah, possibly because of the fact that the French word guillotine has a U in it before the I, they spelled the monster's name. They made that first syllable with two characters, gu and e. Now that u in gu is not like stressed that heavily. Then, of course, you have this additional, you know, sort of LR ambiguity in Japanese. So you end up with this name, Giron, which doesn't really sound like guillotine. So then in coming up with a valid English pronunciation for this monster name, one could make a case that you want to hew closely to the root word, in which case you would read this as Gion. Alternately, you could say, well, a lot of Americans pronounce that word guillotine, in which case you want to call this monster Gillon. Now, those are both totally defensible ways of translating the monster's name. Neither of them hews particularly closely to Giron. So, the way that I see it, then, you have two questions to consider in a relatively Japanese-faithful English pronunciation of that monster's name. And that's, what do you do with that U? And do you do an R or an L? And I think it's basically equally valid to read that G-U-I as Gui and say Giron or Gwilon, or to say, well, the intent there isn't really to get a hard pronounced G sound. So you can just kind of drop it and make it Giron or Gilon. So I'd say for relatively faithful English natural pronunciation of that name, Giron, Gilon, Giron, or Gwilon are all basically equally valid and defensible choices.
I didn't realize that it was taken from guillotine. I think that's interesting. But yeah, that explanation honestly won me over, and I think I'm going to try to pronounce it Giron from now on because it just makes more sense.
Just three last little throwaway things. I thought the establishing shot of Terra just panning across the model was really nicely done. Similarly, when we see the aliens in the shadows with their glowing eyes and their strange speech, very nicely done, very creepy. Maybe that was a reused effect from the previous movie, but since I'm watching these in reverse order and have not seen them, this movie benefits from the exact same thing that Super Monster benefited from, with me being impressed with the quality of effect scenes from movies that had already come before in the series, but that I hadn't watched, so I was really seeing them for the first time in living memory in Super Monster. So my unique reverse order maybe makes this more impressive to me than it would if I had actually watched them in the correct order. And last thing I just noticed is the flashbacks really helped to establish what we get in this movie too. They really have an obsession in these movies with the kids ending up in Gamera's palm. I don't think we got that in Jiger, but like in just about every other one, they just love putting kids in the palm of Gamera's hand. They show it to us twice in flashbacks, and then this movie gets its own entry, doubtless so that we could get a nice montage in the next film that uses all three of them.
You're right. That is perhaps the one part of Gamera's body that they don't end up in Jiger. I wanted to agree about that establishing shot of Terra. I love the miniatures there, and that's where I completely aesthetically buy into the movie. That's where I'm just like, all right, this is a thing that visually I'm 100% on board with.
I think the set for Terra just looks fantastic all around. It just looks super, super good. That's kind of all I really have to say about it. It's very colorful and just fun to look at. And I think the underwater set in this movie is also super good. And honestly, my opinion is that the Gamera films have much better underwater sets than the Godzilla films have. Again, that's just my opinion. Because the Godzilla films, anytime they show an underwater fight, it looks super like murky and there's nothing really in the background and it's just kind of like one solid color and that's just kind of it. But I like how in the Showa Gamera films, there's always like, you know, like rocky formations and everything around and like undersea plants and stuff and like bubbles floating. It just looks super cool. And I just appreciate the underwater sets in the Showa Gamera films. So normally this is the point in the episode where we would talk about the film's score, which in this case was composed by Shunsuke Kikuchi, who is great, and the score works for this movie. There's nothing wrong with it, but none of us really have anything quite to say about it, so we are just going to move right along. And then do any of us have any stray thoughts? Because I don't.
I think we've just recorded 2 hours and 15 minutes of stray thoughts.
Okay.
As has been said, this episode was all stray thoughts.
Yeah, okay. So guys, who's your MVP for this movie? I'll just go right ahead and say that mine is easily Kanomura, who plays Khan, because he just has such a wonderful, endearing presence. And I love every second he's on screen. Him and the little girl are just easily, like we said earlier, the heart of the movie. And I just love seeing them. It's great.
My MVPs are special effects technicians Kayami Izo and Kaofumi Fuji. I apologize for probably butchering their names. For the Gueron versus Space Gauss sequence, that was the highlight of the film for me. I was quite pleasantly surprised with what some of these effects were able to accomplish really throughout the model work, everything. I don't know if Izo or Fuji was more responsible for that, but a large part of my more positive impression this time around stemmed from their work. An honorable mention to monster designer Takeyama Ryosaku for gifting the world with the wonder that is Gueron.
My MVP for this movie is Miyuki Akiyama as Tomoko. As I said, you know, when talking about her character, I think she is by far the best of the child actors in this movie. And I'm genuinely invested in her performance and particularly moved by the scene where we see her out in the field in that beautiful shot, the lovely, lovely wide shot, this little girl just like calling out to promise her brother that help is on the way. Like, she gets to me, man. She gets me right in the heart.
My MVP would be Umenosuke Izumi. I think his portrayal of Gamera is pretty solid, and I think it's easy to relate to him, especially when he's experiencing any sort of pain or he's celebrating or anything. This is one of those movies where I feel like the whole I just enjoy, but the pieces I don't. There's really not much to grab onto. But no, he's great. I love his portrayal of Gamera in this.
So that'll bring us to our final thoughts.
I think this is a rad movie. It ends up being pretty mid-tier for me with Showa Gamera and probably with Gamera as a whole. But it's really entertaining. It's really fun. It's just a simple way, an easy way to kill an hour and a half. It's very entertaining. Great monster fights. Some annoying kids, but that's okay. It makes up for it in spades with some other monster fights and awesome space woman. So yeah, it's a good time.
This is my favorite Showa Gamera movie, as I said at the beginning. Yeah, I think I've pretty well summarized why I find this thing such a garden of delights and a gift that keeps on giving. I've watched it so many times in the last week in preparation for this episode and it hasn't gotten tired for me at all. And I hadn't been that long since the last time I had watched it. Yeah, it's delightful. And my inner six-year-old is forever a fan of it. And I hope it is one of the ones that I saw when I was really young. Hope it is.
If not, you can take solace in knowing that it was one of the ones I saw when I was really young.
Awesome. And it's one of the ones I saw when you were really young.
Also true.
Gamera versus Guiron is, in my book, a terrible children's film. Like I said, I'd planned to watch the English dub with my kids, but no, this thing is not appropriate for my children. That said, compositing issues aside, the production values were really high. The settings were imaginative. I thought the characters had a good rapport, like, you know, the space women and the kids interacted well with each other. Of course, Tomoko and Kam-chan. So while the story was padded in some places, the narrative was also still pretty decent. Guiron is a wonderful concept. And although I think his best set piece comes with Space Gauss, the actual title bout being a bit brief and disappointing for me, this still came off as a pretty solid film. I enjoyed it as an adult, and while it was filled with typical Showa Gamera combinations of silliness and disturbing brutality, it nonetheless ended up a very solid entry that easily retains its close third behind Zegra and Super Monster position for me. Although since the only other entry I have to compare that with is Jiger, it will be interesting to see if its position shifts as I rediscover other Showa Gamera films. For the time being, though, I found it a solid and an enjoyable film. And even if I end up liking other films better than it, that won't change.
And what will not change is that Gamera vs. Zygra is number one. Because Gamera vs. Zygra is the best. Show it. Nick, keep your mouth shut. I don't want to hear it.
I adore this movie. I just think it's so much fun. You know, I think for a long time, and I think arguably still, for most people, Showa Gamera movies are just kind of laughed at rather than laughed with. And really, I think in the case of most of them, I think they're the type of things that should probably be laughed with instead of laughed at. Because really, you know, they're not supposed to really be. I mean, there, I guess there are some parts that you can take seriously, but on the whole, they're mostly just supposed to be fun, goofy monster movies for kids. Like, that's their purpose. None of them, I mean, you can make the case that the first Gamera movie was trying to be the original Godzilla in a very half-baked manner.
Yeah, not very hard.
But after that point, you know, none of them are trying to be masterpieces. It's just fun, man. Just sit down and have fun with it. That's why it's here. And I have so much fun with this movie. Honestly, violence and gore aside, I just think it's kind of adorable. I love it. It's one of my favorite Showa Gamera movies as well. It's just great. So that wraps us up for our 50th episode. If you've been listening since the very beginning of our show, or if this is your first episode, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you so, so much. Before we go, as usual, we've got some listener feedback to read out. This piece of feedback comes from none other than friend of the show, Ethan Storang, about our 48th episode about Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah. Ethan says, "Excellent, excellent, excellent episode of G-Force. I learned, I laughed, and I fell more deeply in love with one of my favorite Godzilla films. I absolutely love this movie, faults and all. This will never not be a G film I'm excited to watch, and I will always love its characters, story, suits, battles, and aesthetic. Interesting take on Glen Chico's name. For my money, most of the subs I've ever seen have listed his name as Glen Chico. And so my thought was always that it was supposed to be a mashing together of an American name, Glen, with a Japanese-compatible suffix, Chico. But honestly, who the hell knows what they were thinking when they wrote that name? Regarding Android M11, what is there to say that you haven't already? Robert Scott Fields makes choices in his delivery that are both unfathomable in their intent, yet ultimately perfect for the character. He's goofy to an almost obscene degree, yet every single aspect of his performance feels so right. M11 will always be a favorite character for me in G-Canon, and I can't imagine this movie without him. I loved your take on comparing Shindo with Godzilla, both in impact and stature. It's something I find myself thinking about a lot each time I watch this movie, and I had always felt the look they share with one another prior to Shindo's death was one between equals. But it never really occurred to me how the skyscraper Shindo made elevated him to the point where he could face Godzilla on equal footing. It's a little surprising how fully intentional that comparison feels, considering how I completely failed to ever pick up on it. Andrew, thank you so much for confirming this movie's time travel rules for me. That's how I've always felt they must be, based on dialogue, but it's never made explicit within the film itself. I'm glad to hear so much love given to Ifukube's score for this film. It's always been one of my favorites, and feels genuinely one of his most powerful. That hiatus from the franchise really lent his compositions a renewed vigor and intensity that serves this movie well. My MVP for this movie is Robert Scott Fields. It's always the unique characters that make me fall in love with a Godzilla film, and it's hard to get more unique than Android M11, though it certainly has been done. I think Nick's transmissive take on Ghidorah and Godzilla being mere images of one another in terms of flexible morality is a really interesting one, and is one I hadn't considered before. More than any other in recent memory, I've really appreciated the unique takes G-Force has had on this film, and feel they've enriched my own viewings of and thoughts about it. Just one of the many reasons I tune in every 2 weeks. As an Anguirus fan who will not, and potentially cannot, shut up about the need for my good Spiky Boy's own franchise, the criminality of his omission from the Heisei era and his underappreciation in the fandom as a whole, it was immensely cathartic to hear someone besides myself stand up for my favorite underdog. Thank you for the healing, Brendan. This has been Ethan, and I would leave behind three adorable puppies, because the one thing the world needs more of in these troubled times isn't love, it's Godzilla versus Mega Cerberus. Thank you so much, Ethan, once again, for sending us your wonderful feedback, and I would absolutely watch the hell out of Godzilla versus Mega Cerberus. So if you want to send us feedback like Ethan did, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/GForceKaijuPod. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at GForceKaijuPod, and you can email us at GForceKaijuPod@gmail.com. And we would really, really appreciate it so much if you would leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We will read out any review we get on the show, and it would really help us reach other kaiju fans, so please do that if you feel so inclined. And you can also rate us on Spotify if you'd like to. Once again, thank you so much for listening to our 50th episode, and we will see you in 2 weeks whenever we discuss episodes 14 through 19 of Godzilla the series, which of course includes the epic 3-part episode arc, Monster Wars. So to close us out, we will each be describing other monsters that the Terrans created. So I've been Nick, and I heard that the Terrans also accidentally created Spatulon, the monster with a spatula for a head.
This has been Andrew, and kaiju really need to watch their fingers in the vicinity of Pilra, a monster of twin parallel cutting blades that dismembers its opponents much more slowly than Gwiron, but just frankly cuts open your fingers more often than anything.
Yo, real talk though. A kaiju that skins other kaiju is horrifying.
Yeah, that's too gruesome for Gamera. That's more of like an Ultraman thing.
Yeah, that's some Ultraman ace right there.
Totally. This has been Evan, and the Terran Guardian monster that I most dread encountering is Seretora, the serrated grapefruit spoon monster, whose grapefruit spoon head can cut into you and dig out big chunks of you. Or, you know, his large opponent, such as Gamera. Could probably even get that thing inside of the holes in Gamera's shell, where his, you know, his limbs and his head retract. So he can get in there and kind of dig at Gamera's head when it's retracted inside. Ooh.
I love how much thought you're putting into this.
I didn't mean to.
This is a very violent episode.
It wasn't my aim. It just happened. This whole episode just happened, guys.
It really did. It did.
If this was in Zone Fighter, the subtitle would be like the Melon Ball Monster.
Exactly.
This has been Parker, and I think in secret they created Gratora, which was the giant cheese grater monster that would run around and suck kaiju into his giant cheese grater slides. Pretty violently, but not as violently as Evan's monster.
This is kind of like a kaiju version of the Shredder.
Or a kaiju version of Kirby.
I like how the spatula one, there's no violence.
He's just going to smack you. He's just going to... That's
working just as good
as it. Hey,
it can flip you. It can get under Gamera and flip him on his back because he's a turtle. but then he has the jets, so it doesn't matter. That was literally a plot point in the first Gamera movie.
Yeah, but before he can use the jets, then Sarada comes over and gets in it.
Oh my god.
Wow. And Gotora just sits there and goes, well, you know, I can't do anything because they make shredded cheese in packets now, so I'm kind of useless.
I make it very like fervent in talking about the difference between the two dubs.
As one does.
I've never seen any of the dubs for the Showa Gamera films.
That's probably a good thing, to be honest.
What about, like, did you ever watch the MST3Ks?
I came like this close to buying that set one day, and I decided not to because I was always like, I'll never watch them. Like, if I ever want to watch Gamera versus Gauss, I'm going to watch Gamera versus Gauss. I'm not going to watch that. One of these days, for the sake of a complete collection, I will buy them.
Yeah.
But no, I've never actually seen those. I've actually never seen any full episode of Mystery Science Theater.
Huh.
I should probably fix that.
Well, the whole thing where they refer to Officer Kondo as Corn Job on Mystery Science Theater 3000, that could only happen because of the specific dub they were using, because one dub calls him Konchan and the other doesn't. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay.
Corn Job is like the only joke from that show that I know off the top of my head.
Nick, like, you're wearing the coolest shirt right now. Don't cover up the shirt. What's wrong with you?
I'm not. What? Who's covering up the shirt?
Said you're wearing the. It looks like you're putting on a sweater and you're wearing like the cool shirt.
Yeah. I'm trying to do the blanket thing because I'm trying to reduce the echo.
Everyone brought their A game on their shirts tonight.
Well, almost everyone. When strange radio waves from space are detected, scientists are all abuzz. But Akio, his little wow, that's a promising start.
David Callett. It was an enlightening experience listening to that Cadio Amenter. It was...
For the Guiron versus Skase Gauss. That's a new one. I was really hoping for a Spork, Mr. Spock kind of connection to click in my brain, but nothing would come through.
Mr. Spork?
Yeah, you know, but there's not really anything to do with kaiju anymore, so it's just, you know.
Yeah, but the idea of a kaiju named Mr. Spork is amazing.
This has got to be one of our strangest episode endings that we've ever recorded.
Yeah, it tracks the whole episode. The whole episode has been like this.
I love that this has just been a manic fever dream of an episode for our 50th.
Like Gamera versus Euron.